have guessed the answer straight away. Miss Mote nodded her head slowly, as if to say, I might have known some idiot would suggest that. And what, pray tell, if the radiator is full of antifreeze? She asked, in a voice dripping with sarcasm. Remember, Gremley, we live in a harsh northern climate, and not, as you seem to suppose, in the land of the bandaged pharaohs. Some of us laughed dutifully, but others didn't. A dark image flashed on a screen in a back room of my mind, then quickly flickered out.
The lake, Scarlet suggested. We could bring water from the lake in buckets and boil it.
It's seawater, Gremley interrupted. The salt would make us sick.
It's not salt water,
Scarlet shot back, fanning her face furiously, even more alarmingly red.
Any fool knows that the Great Lakes...
Girls, girls, girls,
Miss Mote shouted, wheeling her chair round with surprising speed, charging into the middle of our little group like a Roman chariot, I thought, and almost running us over. I noticed now for the first time that the Sevens were standing in silence. It occurred to me that several of its members, Jumbo for certain, because she was head girl, had been through this exercise before, and knew perfectly well the expected answers. Why, then, was she here? Why was she keeping quiet? Had she been ordered to? Was this whole stupid beanfest being staged for my benefit? Or for the handful of us who were the latest arrivals? Which of us, then, were the players, and which of us the audience in this charade? I decided to dig in my oar. Water may be obtained, I said, by finding the lowest point of the terrain, constructing a condensation trap. My girl guide days hadn't been entirely wasted.
Correct, Miss Mote snapped. Bowles will demonstrate the correct technique.
Bowles? I didn't connect until Jumbo marched off down a slight slope to the west. Of course, Bowles was Jumbo's surname. Miss Mote did not follow as the lot of us struggled off in Jumbo's footsteps. At the bottom of a gully, Jumbo dragged a rusty garden spade from behind a tree.
First thing to know, be prepared, she said, and began digging.
It was obvious, at least to me, that she had done this before, and at this very spot. The soil was unusually loose.
Give us your Macintosh, Druce, she ordered,
and Druce reluctantly handed over a tightly bundled waterproof packet.
Druce is always prepared, aren't you, Druce?
Yes, Jumbo, Druce said meekly. But be careful. My mother said she'd beat my brains out if I ruined it.
No danger of that, Jumbo said, and everyone, even Druce, smiled as she began digging.
Scarlet and I stood off to one side to watch.
About Brazenose,
I prompted her quietly, keeping my eyes on the growing hole in the ground. Scarlet's eyes went as wide as the dog's in the fairy tale.
I saw her last night, she whispered.
What?
The word flew out of my mouth before I could turn down the volume.
Come on, you two, Jumbo said. Stop horsing around and pay attention. This is serious. I'm not having black marks against my name because of you slackers.
Caught in the act. Think fast, Flavia.
I threw my hand over my mouth and turned quickly away. With my back to Jumbo, I rammed my middle finger down my throat and gave my uvula a jolly good prod. The uvula is that little fleshy stalactite that hangs down from the back of one's throat. And its sole purpose, as far as I can tell, is to trigger a quick vomit when one is required on short notice, as it was now. I spun round, took a couple of reeling steps, and threw up into Jumbo's condensation trap. Andrews's Macintosh. Just enough to be convincing.
Sorry, Drews, I said, trying to look repentant. It must have been the bus. Motion sickness and so forth.
Oh, you poor kid, Jumbo said. I'm sorry. I thought you were just clowning around, honestly. This was even better than I'd expected. Sympathy and an apology to boot. I waved off her words gracefully and set off on unsteady legs for the closest tree trunk. Go with her, Scarlet. Fetch her a cold drink. There's a canteen in the bus. And so it came to pass that Scarlet and I found ourselves propped comfortably under an elm, watching the others clean up the contaminated condensation trap. Which goes to show that the old saying is true, that just when things seem blackest, things often turn out for the best. The darkness before the dawn, etc. Now then, I said, tell me about Brazenose. Scarlet was still gaping a little.
You're astonishing, she said.
No more so than you, Amelia, I told her, realizing, even as I spoke, that since my arrival at Miss Bodycote's, she was the only person I had dared address by her given name. It was you in your apoplexy that suggested it to me, I said.
No, don't laugh. They'll be on to us.
Scarlet replied by moistening her handkerchief and dabbing with great concern at my supposedly overheated brow.
You fraud,
she said in a low but scandalized whisper as she added a sheen of counterfeit sweat to my forehead.
About Brazenose, I reminded her. Feed me the facts. I saw her last night.
She paused to let the effect of her words sink in.
Saw her? I thought she disappeared. I thought Miss Fawthorne, or someone, murdered her. I thought she was dead.
So did I, Scarlet said, and so did everyone else. For a few seconds, my mind felt like one of those fence posts you see in the news photos. Posts impaled by flying straws in a tornado as easily as if they were pincushions. The sheer power of the impossible.
Are you sure? I asked.
Of course I'm sure, Scarlet said, giving me the ghost of a dirty look.
I'd know her anywhere.
She said this with such certainty that I knew she was speaking the truth.
Where was this? I asked. And when? Last night, just after study, she was coming out of the laundry.
Good Lord, this was like something out of one of Daffy's Victorian chillers. The Lady in White or something. The spectre, briefly glimpsed, which then promptly vanishes. I seized Scarlet's wrist and stopped her dabbing at my forehead, an action which had now become so mechanical that it seemed more likely to attract attention than to deflect it.
Tell me, I said, from the beginning, don't leave anything out.
50 yards away, the two groups of girls had combined into one, and having filled in the corrupted condensation pit, were now, under Jumbo's supervision, rather lethargically digging another. At the top of the embankment, Miss Smote had vanished from sight.
It was just getting dark, Scarlet said. I remembered I had left my hockey stick in the grass behind the net. Miss Puddycombe would be furious if I let it warp.
The very thought of the hatchet-faced gamesmistress made me shiver, in spite of the sunshine, which was now creeping under the tree as if to be with us. I had just come back across the field and was going round that bit of wall that sticks out beside the laundry, when the door opened. It was just dark enough that I saw the light thrown out onto the gravel path, and someone's shadow. I ducked back before she could see me. But it was Clarissa Brazenose, I'm sure of it.
How could you tell if she was no more than a silhouette?
I'd know her anywhere, Scarlet said. Besides, she turned toward the light as she turned to switch it off, and I had a good look at her face. Honest. Scarlet scratched across my heart promise on her blouse, and I believed her.
And then?
She hurried round the laundry and into that little stone passageway beside the kitchen. It goes clear through to the street.
Yes, I know, I said.
Did you follow her?
Of course I didn't,
Scarlet scoffed.
I didn't want to be caught, remember? Besides, I was petrified. I thought I'd seen a ghost.
Here it was. Ghosts again. The haunted convent.
Do ghosts switch off lights behind themselves? I asked. Do they even need to turn them on?
Ha ha, very clever, Miss Flavia Deleuze. I told you this because your mother was supposedly such a brain. I thought you might be too, but I can see that I was wrong. I wasn't expecting you to poke fun at me.
I'm not poking fun, I reassured her.
I was merely thinking aloud. Don't be so touchy. I'm trying to help.
We were silent for a moment, each of us licking her invisible wounds. On the one hand, I did not like having Harriet slighted, not even obliquely. But on the other, I could sympathize with Scarlet, who, like me, had probably been bundled up and shipped off to school without so much as a fare thee well and mind the flypaper. We were a couple of tender souls tossed together into a cement mixer. Look, I said, taking a chance and hoping I wouldn't regret it later.
We're a team, you and I.
I thought, just for an instant, of my other so-called partner, Adam Sowerby, even though I had never actually agreed verbally to a partnership with him. Adam was too secretive, and, let's face it, too old to be trusted fully. At this very moment, he would be poking round some mouldy, ivied ruin of an English castle, pretending to be searching for seeds, yet all the while prying into Lord somebody or another's activities during the war, and all for some dark master whose identity he refused to reveal, even though it could well be, in fact, my own Aunt Felicity.
Complicated?
I should say so. Just the thought of it drove me crazy. Scarlet did not reply, but what she did was this. She reached for my hand and gave it a coded squeeze. 1, 2, pause, 3, just like that. And so the deal was sealed.
Now then, I said, about Clarissa Brasenose. When did you see her last? Apart from last night, I mean.
It was the night of the Beaux Arts Ball, so it must have been June, the year before last. I'm quite sure of that, because I was wearing my Cinderella dress with short sleeves and long gloves. I remember thinking how odd I must look, creeping round the hockey pitch in that get-up. Not that many people would see me, of course. Not with the ball going on, and not with it being after dark. It must have been well after 9. 20 past, perhaps.
The Beaux Arts Ball? I asked.
It's a tradition. Everyone comes to it. Faculty, staff, students, the board of guardians, even some of the parents come as chaperones. They hand out prizes for deportment and stuff like that. I got one for washing and ironing.
You're joking.
No, I'm not. I'll show it to you sometime if you don't believe me. It's a little silver-plated mangle.
Thank you, but no, I said. I'll take your word for it.
Do you mean you saw Brasenose at the same spot last night as you did 2 years ago, just before she vanished?
Scarlet nodded, biting her lower lip.
But listen, why would Brasenose be in the laundry after dark? 2 years ago, I mean. Why wasn't she at the ball?
Scarlet shrugged.
Brasenose was a sixth former, and she'd been here for donkeys. She must have been 16. She could pretty well do as she liked, as long as she didn't attract too much attention.
I said, my mind milling the possibilities. One would not ordinarily go to a laundry after dark.
If one did, it would almost certainly be to pick up some piece of clothing that had been forgotten, an item that had not been retrieved during normal working hours, one that had been suddenly, and perhaps unexpectedly, required. Perhaps something had happened that made Brasenose want to run away. But would a girl of 16, who had been at the school for ages, be likely to do that?
not unless something unthinkable had happened. Perhaps she had gone to the laundry, not to pick something up, but to drop something off. But what could be so urgent that she couldn't leave it in her room until the next day? "What day of the week was the ball held?" I asked.
"Saturday. It's always on a Saturday."
The laundry would almost certainly have been locked up for the weekend, which made it even more strange. Could it be that Brazenose had crept off from the Beaux Arts Ball to meet someone? And why the laundry? Why not the common room, or the great hall, or any of the dozens of other places where two could talk without fear of interruption? "Did Brazenose have any particular friends?" I asked.
"No,"
Scarlet said. "She was rotten popular. She played badminton, squash, and tennis. She bicycled, knitted, sewed, sketched, and painted with watercolors. She was a member of the drama club and the debating society, and she was the editor of the New Broom. That's our school newspaper." Was I detecting a note of resentment in Scarlett's words? And I couldn't help but notice her repeated use of the past tense. But perhaps that was unavoidable when referring to someone who hadn't been seen for more than 2 years. "How did you feel about her?" I asked. Daffy would have been proud of me. It was the kind of bear trap question that her beloved Sigmund Freud would have asked.
"She was all right, I suppose," Scarlet said. "She made the rest of us look bad, though." And then she added, "In much the same way, I expect that..."
But she cut herself off short.
"Yes?" "Oh, nothing."
I licked the tip of my mental pencil and made a note. Query. Brazenose resented for brains in general? Harriet and Flavia ditto? "And what do you believe happened to her?" I asked, a sudden probe without warning. Again, I thought how remarkably time can sometimes slow to a crawl. The wings of a bird in midair slowed to the speed of breakers on a beach, an arrow suspended in flight halfway to the bull's eye. My mind flew back to the night of my arrival, to the flag-wrapped body tumbling out of the fireplace, to the skull detaching itself and rolling to a grisly halt at my feet. Had Collingwood recognized what was left of the face? It seemed unlikely, given the condition of the corpse. But if she had, let's just say she had she told anyone? We had still not heard, either from Inspector Gravenhurst or from the news reports, that the body had been identified. With all the radios that blared in dormitories in the early morning, we could scarcely have missed it, which meant either that the police were withholding the information because they were having difficulty getting in touch with next of kin, or that they didn't know. And, come to think of it, I hadn't laid eyes on Collingwood since that horrific but utterly fascinating night. All of this raced through my mind as I waited for Scarlet to answer. She seemed to be having difficulty making her mouth move.
"I believe," she said at last, her eyes as large and damp as peeled grapes. "I believe she..." Three!
Three sharp blasts on a pea whistle came from the top of the embankment. Miss Mote, in her wheelchair, was making impatient "come here at once" motions with her arm. Sixes and sevens were dissolved as the two groups swarmed together and went scrambling up the slope. Under the elm, Scarlet and I got slowly to our feet. She put a solicitous arm round my shoulder, supporting poor, sick Flavia's weight, and we crept as clumsily as a conjoined crustacean up the embankment. Halfway to the top, pretending to lose her footing and floundering for traction, she contrived to bring her mouth so close to my face that I could feel her breath hot upon my cheek.
questions, she rasped into my ear. She asked too many questions.
Chapter 15. Lunch had been brought in the bus, and we picnicked upon pink bricks of tinned pork, boiled eggs, and Brazil nuts that looked like devil's toenails, those fossilized bivalves from the Jurassic period, all of it washed down with milk from a galvanized carrier that had stood in the sun for too long. Drusen Trout had plopped down on either side of me without invitation. In future, I decided, I would make it a rule not to be the first to sit. If Aunt Felicity were here, she would likely be pointing out that patience, to a point, provides choice. She probably had an elaborate mathematical formula to work out the optimum time to sit when in a group of 13. How I miss the dear old girl. I was wondering how Miss Mote, being wheelchair-bound, would fit into the equation when I realized that Druce was speaking to me. I said, how does it feel to be a dog? She repeated. I beg your pardon, I asked, bristling. Don't make me chew my cabbage twice, she said. How does it feel to be a dog? You know, D-O-G, daughter of a goddess. Trout collapsed into the grass, cackling helplessly at the wit of her mistress. Ah, I laughed airily, I hoped. About the same, I expect, as it does to be a D-O-B. I left her to work it out. Druce's face clouded, then brightened suddenly as she forced a smile. Listen, she said, as if butter wouldn't melt in her mandibles. I've been wanting to ask, are you one of us? Us? I summoned up and assumed utility mask number 7, the village idiot. Yes, you know, us. Was it my imagination, or did the word have a hiss in it? I was aware, of course, that this might be an official test of my ability to keep a zipped lip when it came to the exchange of personal information.
Come on, Trout blurted. You're a boarder, aren't you? Just like us. You have to know.
Drew shot her a poisonous look, and Trout began furiously digging an unconscious hole for herself in the dirt with the end of a twig.
Well? Druce insisted.
Well, what? I asked. Village idiots are not thrown out of character as easily as all that.
Don't play the fool with me, she snapped.
If only she knew how close to the mark she was.
I'm sorry, I said, throwing my open hands upward in puzzlement and hauling my shoulders up round my ears. If you mean, am I a pupil at Miss Bodycote's, or am I in the fourth form, then the answer, obviously, is yes. Otherwise, I haven't the foggiest idea what you're talking about.
I should have left out the obviously.
Right then, she said, just so we know where we stand.
And she matched her actions to her words by getting to her feet.
Come on, Trout, she said. Let's sit somewhere else. Something here stinks.
They walked with stiff necks, like a pair of Old Testament princesses, to the shade of another tree, where they sat down again with their backs to me.
Ugh, said a voice behind me. Ignore those chumps.
It was Gremly, the gnomish girl I had seen at the Ouija seance in Jumbo's room. She squatted beside me, plucked a blade of grass, and began to chew on it reflectively.
I've been watching you, she said. You're okay.
Thank you, I told her, because I didn't know what else to say. We sat in silence for a long moment, not looking at each other, and then Gremly spoke.
I can tell. You're a person who enjoys her pheasant sandwiches.
The world stopped. My heart stopped.
Pheasant sandwiches.
The very words Winston Churchill had spoken to me 5 months ago on the railway platform at Buckshaw Holt. the exact words my mother, Harriet, had mouthed toward the camera in the ancient cine film I had found in the attic at Buckshaw. Pheasant sandwiches, the secret words that identified the speaker as a member of the Nide.
The phrase was chosen carefully, Aunt Felicity had told me. Innocuous to the casual observer, but a clear warning of danger to an initiate.
Gremley had spoken it very matter-of-factly, almost too casually. Was she giving me a warning, or was she simply making herself known? I tried not to appear panic-stricken as I looked round at the small groups of girls seated here and there in the grass. Had anyone noticed? No one seemed to be paying us the slightest attention.
I know I do, she prattled on, as if nothing had happened. Quite a welcome break from your usual cucumber and soggy lettuce. Still, peanut butter and banana is my own favorite. Rather exotic so far north, don't you think?
Could this possibly be the same creature who had crouched, mumbling over her words, at the Ouija session? If so, she was an absolute wizard of camouflage, and I was filled with admiration. Yes, I said with a smile. Pheasant is pleasant. And then we both tittered. Just two little girls picnicking in the sunshine, relishing all the millions of words that remained unspoken between us. Again came the shriek of Miss Smote's infuriating whistle.
Thwee! Thwee! Thwee!
Girls! Girls! Girls!
Did the blasted woman do everything in threes? My mind boggled at the thought.
Form a column. Off you go, no straggling.
Her extended finger was pointing us toward the cluster of wooden huts that lay slightly to the south. Dud it, dud it, Gremley said, making the high-pitched sound of a ship-to-shore telegraph with her mouth. Dit-da-dit, dit-da, dit-da-da-dit. Even though I couldn't decipher the code, I understood the meaning by the tone of her voice and the rebellious look on her face. Miss Mote shot us a sour glare, but said nothing. At the huts, there was trouble with the keys, and the bus driver had to be sent for to open the door. As we stood waiting in the sun, Gremley raised an eyebrow almost imperceptibly, and I couldn't help but grin. There are times when eyebrows speak louder than words. I knew as well as she did that either one of us could have had it open in a quarter of a trice, blindfolded, with both arms in plaster casts. Two of the older and larger girls lifted Miss Motes's wheelchair across the threshold in a bizarre reenactment of the honeymoon rituals I had seen in the cinema. This time, however, there was no waiting bottle of champagne and no discreet fade-out. The inside of the hut contained not much more than half a dozen rickety trestle tables with folding chairs, a pot-bellied iron stove with a twisted pipe, and a bird's nest that had fallen out of the rafters. The place smelled of ancient dust, of plaster, and of rising damp. A strange uneasiness shimmered in the air. For some peculiar reason, I felt as Jack must have felt, when having climbed the beanstalk, he was forced to hide out, barely breathing, in the giant's kitchen cupboard. I know it sounds strange, but that's as close as I can come to describing the tense atmosphere of the place, as if something unseen were coiled, waiting. Miss Mote opened several drawers of a painted counter and dragged out an enormous octopus of tangled cables, telegraph keys, and headsets, which she distributed as if they were the riches of King Solomon.
Dit, 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 da,
Gremley said triumphantly.
Didn't I tell you?
I knew perfectly well that she was forming the letter V for victory. The same pattern of four notes that Beethoven had used for the opening of his Fifth Symphony. Without warning, a tidal wave of homesickness broke over me. My mind was suddenly aswim with images of Father, Feely, Daffy, and me, aged 6, sitting among the hanging ferns in the study at Buckshaw, listening to those opening chords of doom on the wireless. I should have known that, as Daffy would say, they did not bode well. But it was now too late for tears. I could never remember, in my entire life, feeling so alone. I thought I was going to vomit, and this time it would be the real thing. I pretended to wipe a speck of rogue grit from my eye. I sat, shaken, at the table, unable to speak, and the taste of ashes in my mouth. "In twos," Miss Mote said, and I grabbed at Gremley's hand before anyone else could do so. We sat across from each other at a trestle table, upon which someone with a penknife had carved "Kilroy was here," and other things which I will not take the trouble to repeat. Jumbo handed out pencils and papers from a canvas knapsack that looked as if it had seen service during the Trojan War.
"I'll send, you receive," Gremley told me. "I've done it before. It will be easier this way."
She handed me a card upon which were printed the letters of the alphabet and the numerals from 1 to 0. A dot dash, B dash dot dot dot, C dash dot dash dot, and so forth. I clapped the headphones over my ears, plugged them into a chipped enamel terminal box, and Gremley gave the key a couple of presses. Dit dit da dit. I looked it up on the card and found that it was an F. Dit da dit dit.
L.
Dit da.
A.
She was tapping out my name. This was easy. I already knew what was coming next. The familiar dit 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 da.
V.
I smiled to let her know I was getting the hang of it, and picked up a pencil. Gremley gave her head an almost imperceptible shake.
Da dit?
Da da da, she sent. No, I was not to write it down. I pressed the cold cups of the headset to my ears. No one else could hear the dots and dashes, at least I hoped they couldn't. But with 6 girls tapping away at the same time, it seemed impossible that anyone in the room would be able to pick out the sounds of a single key.
T-R-U-S-T.
N-O-O-N-E, Gremley tapped out. I read it at first as trust noon, but quickly realized my error. She must have seen my puzzlement. No one, she sent again. Keep away from...
Well,
Miss Mote said suddenly, slapping the surface of our table for attention.
How are you getting on?
I nearly sprang out of my skin. Neither of us had heard her coming. I tore off the headset.
Gremley's just telegraphed my name. F-L-A-V-I-A, I said. What jolly good fun!
For an instant, I considered bursting into Gilbert and Sullivan.
3 little maids who all unwary come from a lady seminary, freed from its genius tutelary, 3 little maids from school.
But I didn't. Miss Mote looked from one of us to the other, and without another word, moved on to lurk somewhere else.
My turn, I said loudly. Let me try.
And we swapped, sending key and headset.
Where's Collingwood? I tapped out slowly, picking the letters from the chart.
Gremley removed the headphones and placed them over my ears. It was an awkward way of carrying on a conversation, but it would have to do.
Infirmary, she sent. Gone mad.
Chapter 16. The spatter of rain, which had begun as we left the huts, had now become a downpour. A pair of sluggish wipers swept sheets of water from the windshield, and it had become suddenly cold. My short sleeves were no protection, and I hugged my arms against my body. Gremley did not sit with me on the bus. Quite the contrary. She had gone far to the rear to sit in the shadow of Miss Mote, leaving me up front behind the driver, pretending to appreciate the beauty of the landscape, which was made up principally of tall elms in rain-swept fields, glimpses of the lake, and the occasional wrecker's yard in which the rusting hulks of once-loved automobiles were piled like so many colossal steel anthills. Again, the word disorientated flashed into my mind. It meant, essentially, having lost one's compass bearings, which is what had happened to me. Cast out from my childhood home, banished to a strange land, and now isolated even from the low, goose-like gabble of my classmates. I was alone in the world, at the mercy of even the slightest gust of wind. I needed to focus my mind on something outside myself, to regain the scientific view and so to resettle my soul. But where to begin? Trust no one, Miss Fallthorne and Gremley had each told me, and when you stop to think about it rationally, that included even them. I needed to seem to the faculty of Miss Bodycoats an apt pupil, to the other girls an invisible bore. There was only one way I could think of to achieve this with a minimum of fuss.
"Slowly, slowly," Fitzgibbon said, helping me up the stairs.
I made my hand tremble on her arm as I tottered my way upward. I had managed a small but convincing vomit at the curbside, which I was inordinately proud of. Miss Mote had insisted I report to the nurse, exactly as I had intended she should. A few more dry heaves on the stairs for insurance, and I had won the toss, so to speak.
"Thank you, matron," I managed.
"Don't try to talk," she said. "You didn't drink any of the groundwater at the camp, did you?"
The camp, that's what it was called. I shook my head.
"Milk only," I managed.
"Good," she said. "You've got at least half a chance, then."
Was she being what Daffy called ironical? Irony, she had explained, was a special class of sarcasm in which the meaning was the opposite of what it seemed. It was an art at which I had not yet become as adept as I should have liked, although it was high on my list of things to do. Even recognizing it, though, was a major accomplishment, and I was quite proud to have possibly done so.
"The infirmary's in here," she said, leading me through a dark, narrow passage that joined the front of the house to one of the more obscure wings.
At a white-painted door, she jangled her keys noisily, as if she were warning someone inside that we were about to enter.
"Will the nurse be long?" I asked.
"The nurse is standing before you," she said.
Spotting my bewilderment, she added,
"I'm the nurse, or at least I was before the budget cuts. Nowadays I'm plain old matron with three pairs of perfectly good white Oxfords lying unused in my portmanteau."
I nodded as if I understood.
"Now, in your mother's time, those were the days. We had a fully kitted-out dispensary and the authority to use it. Nowadays it's all Band-Aids and iodine and cod liver oil. Shocking, but there you are. The war did something to the world, and we haven't seen the worst of it yet."
The door came open suddenly, and she beckoned me inside. The infirmary overlooked the hockey field, and would have been a pleasant enough place if it hadn't been for the rain. Curtains of green-looking water shimmered down the panes, giving the infirmary a weird glow, as if it were lit by phosphorus, which, oddly enough, made me feel more at home than I had since my arrival at the academy. Fitzgibbon put a finger to her lips and pointed to a hanging curtain on the far side of the room. I could see, below its gatherings, the legs of a white iron bed.
"Collingwood," she whispered. "She's not doing well, poor child.
I don't expect she'll be much trouble, though. She's sleeping the clock away at the moment."
As she spoke, Fitzgibbon was turning down the sheets of another bed at the far end of the room. From a small glass cupboard between the windows, she selected a tent-like cotton nightgown that might have been worn by Wendy in Peter Pan.
"Put that on and climb in," she said, "and I'll see to you directly."
Like a magician producing a rabbit from a hat, she pulled a second ring of keys from somewhere about her person, and turning away, went to another glass cupboard that was tucked away in an alcove. By the time she returned, I had flattened myself and pulled the sheet up to my chin.
"Temperature first," she said,
and a clinical thermometer appeared in her hand. I noticed that it was one of the type invented in the 17th century at Padua, by Sanctorio Santorius, but not perfected until 1867 by Sir Thomas Olbert in Leeds, a clever device based upon the uniform expansion of mercury from a reservoir into a narrow, calibrated glass tube.
"Open up," she told me. "This will tell me if you've got a temperature."
I nodded dumbly as she shoved the thing under my tongue. I gave a little moan and rolled my eyes to look up at her appealingly. So far, things were going precisely according to plan.
"Sorry," she said. "I know it's unpleasant, but we need 8 minutes to get an accurate reading. Don't move. Don't bite down on it. I'll be right back."
She crossed the room and went behind the curtain that hid Collingwood's bed. My acute sense of hearing told me she was fussing with the pillows and pouring water from a pitcher into a glass. I whipped the thermometer out of my mouth and began rubbing it fiercely with the corner of the bedsheet pinched tightly between thumb and forefinger. One of the many happy things about physics is that it works anywhere in the world, no matter whether you're in Bishop's Lacey or Bombay. Friction is friction. The red column of mercury was already beginning to climb, but not quickly enough. I could still see Fitzgibbon's legs below Collingwood's curtain, but I wouldn't have much time left. "Hold on," I thought. With its more abundant free fibres, my cotton gown might have a higher coefficient of friction than the linen bedsheet. I put my hem to work. That was better. As I rubbed frantically, the red column was rising like billy-ho. It was already above 100 degrees on the Fahrenheit scale. I kept up the rubbing until I saw Fitzgibbon's feet begin moving toward the end of Collingwood's bed. I quickly shoved the instrument back under my tongue and gave another little moan to encourage Fitzgibbon to take a rapid reading. As she came into view from behind the curtain, I tossed restlessly.
"Easy," she said. "Don't bite down, remember. We don't want to lose you to mercury poisoning, do we?"
"I should say we didn't."
Mercury poisoning was one of the most ghastly poisonings in the catalogue of chemistry. The hellish burning, the itching, the swelling, the shedding of skin, the strangulation, the endless stream of saliva like a cow with pasture bloat, and, finally, the loss of bodily functions.
"No,"
I whispered weakly. Fitzgibbon pulled the thermometer from my mouth and glanced at it. I could see her eyes widen.
She said, "a bit higher than I'd like."
I have observed that unless it's normal, they never tell you what your actual temperature is. They'd rather leave it to your fevered imagination than tell the truth. Even dear old Dr. Darby, back home in Bishop's Lacey, had been evasive when I fell off the roof after my spectacular and widely tut-tutted Christmas fireworks display. I rolled away and groaned as Fitzgibbon reached out to feel my forehead.
"I'll have the doctor look at you when he comes by later," she said. "For now, I'll give you an aspirin for your fever. Try to have a little sleep. It's remarkable what a little sleep can do."
I nodded and closed my eyes. The sooner I could get her out of the room, the better. At least the doctor wasn't coming until later, by which time I would have done what I had come to do, and would be well on the way to the most miraculous recovery in medical history. Was it wrong to be so deceitful? Well, yes, it probably was. But if God hadn't wanted me to be the way I am, he would have arranged to have me born a Haddock instead of Flavia Deleuze, wouldn't he? As soon as Fitzgibbon was out of the room, I counted to 23, then leapt out of bed and dashed to Collingwood's bedside. If I were caught out, I would pretend that I was delirious. Collingwood's face was as white as a pillow. Her long hair spread out round her in waves, as if she were a mermaid under water.
"Collingwood," I whispered in her ear. "It's me, Deleuze. Wake up."
She didn't stir.
"Collingwood!"
Louder this time. Although the infirmary was somewhat off the beaten track, I didn't want to attract the attention of anyone who just happened to be passing.
"Collingwood!"
I pressed my thumbnail into her upper lip, a consciousness test I had learned the hard way at a Girl Guide summer camp. She groaned.
"Collingwood, wake up! It's me, Flavia!"
One bloodshot eye came slowly open and stared out at me blearily.
"What?"
she managed, and the smell of her breath made my blood curdle. I recognized it at once. That acrid stab of chlorine embedded in an exotic aromatic odor, like a diamond in a dung heap. Chloral hydrate. I'd know it anywhere. C2H3C13O2. Unmistakable. I had once happened upon a box of the jellied red capsules in the bedside table of the vicar's wife, broken one open for a sniff, and added it to my store of chemical memories. The stuff was, I knew, a powerful hypnotic. If I were myself, I should have spotted at once how troubling Fitzgibbon's statement was, that Collingwood was sleeping the clock away. I could understand her being badly shocked by the body tumbling out of the chimney. But that was ages ago. How could she still be sleeping so much after all this time? I should have thought of it sooner, but living in this Alice in Wonderland world had obviously blunted my usually razor-keen perceptions.
"Everything's fine," I told her, even though it wasn't.
Except for beds, curtains and windows, and a sink, the room was bare.
But wait!
My eyes and my brain lighted upon the cupboard in the alcove. In less than half a flash, I was peering through the glass at the school's medical supplies. Band-aids and cod liver oil, Fitzgibbon had said. But there was quite a bit more than that, actually. Gauze bandages, surgical cotton, tape and scissors, iodine, mercurochrome, aspirin, mustard, for making plasters and poultices, I supposed. A folded sling, a white enamel kidney bowl, tweezers, rubber gloves, tongue depressors. All of it, unfortunately, behind glass. I tried the door, but it was locked. I let slip a quiet curse. I could, in a pinch, break the glass, but that seemed a bit extreme, and besides, the noise would more than likely attract attention. I had foolishly left my crucifix lockpicks on the washstand when I scrubbed my face and neck. Another proof that cleanliness, besides being next to godliness, could also be foolhardy. A quick glance round the room showed that there was nothing from which I could quickly improvise a suitable tool. A bedspring might have served in a pinch, but there wasn't time. My eye fell upon the glass cupboard from which Fitzgibbon had taken my nightgown. It was identical, both white, both glass-plated. They had been bought as a pair. I must have looked like a harpy in a tent as I flapped quickly toward the windows.
Let there be, let there be, let there be. And yes, there was a key in the keyhole. My prayers had been answered.
Identical cupboards, identical keys, or so I hoped. The key was cold in my hand as I flew back across the infirmary, and to my ears anyway, the resulting click was as welcome as a lost symphony of Beethoven. In all these years, it had never occurred to anyone that the key for the linen cupboard would also open the dispensary. With not a moment to waste, I took the tin of mustard to the sink, turned on the tap, and waited for the water to run hot. I took the glass of water Fitzgibbon had poured for Collingwood, dumped it down the drain, and refilled it with warmish water. Into this I added what I judged to be 6 teaspoons of the powdered mustard, which I stirred with the surgical scissors.
"Collingwood,"
I whispered urgently, hauling her up with an arm behind her shoulders.
"Drink this."
Her eyes came open, both of them this time, dreadful, upon mine.
"Drink," I told her. "You must."
Somehow her lips attached themselves to the rim of the glass, like a bivalve trying to climb out of a swimming pool. She choked, gagged twice, and wrenched her head away. All things considered, she was remarkably strong, but I was stronger. I wedged her head back with the rim of the glass and dumped the liquid down her throat, struggling all the while. It was not a pleasant task, something like trying to force-feed a bedridden grampus, but I persisted. In the end, I managed to get about half the stuff into her stomach, with the other half splattered equally upon myself, the bed, and the floor. She was coughing and choking and sobbing, and through it all her eyes blazed at me as if they were weapons. I stood by with the kidney dish, a pillar of strength dressed in a Bedouin's tent. For just a moment, I had a horrid flashback to being Balthazar in the Christmas pageant at St. Tancred's, and being made to sing, "Myrrh is mine, its bitter perfume breathes a life of gathering gloom, sorrowing, sighing, bleeding, dying, sealed in a stone-cold tomb." At first, it seemed as if nothing was going to happen. The darkness before dawn, the calm before the storm. But it didn't take long. Collingwood gave a couple of surprised hiccups, followed by a long sigh. Her face was almost placid. And then, suddenly, she gave a great gulp. Her lips dragged themselves down at the corners, and up it all came. I held her head as great gouts of the reeking stuff came gushing out of her and into the waiting kidney dish. It was my own spare-of-the-moment vomiting at the camp that had given me the idea. That, and the knowledge that a mustard-induced tossing of the cookies was the best, and perhaps only, antidote to poisoning by chloral hydrate. Had Fitzgibbon administered a fresh dose of the stuff under my very nose? Had she roused Collingwood enough to swallow a capsule or a spoonful of syrup? Or, worse, to administer an injection by hypodermic needle? I hadn't heard anything, but that would argue for the syringe, wouldn't it? Why were they keeping this child asleep? Was it to guard her own sanity? Or was there a far more sinister reason? Had she, for instance, seen too much? Was it because she had been caught making notes on the missing girls? Collingwood fell back against the pillows, her face ghastly, her breathing only slowly returning to normal. Whoops-a-daisy! There was more where that came from. I barely had time to get the bowl into position when she was at it again.
"Sorry,"
she wheezed, gasping horribly. A good sign. An excellent sign, in fact. Anyone who could apologize while puking still possessed a brain able to function at the highest levels of decency. I patted her on the back. More? I asked solicitously. She shook her head. Good, I said, and I meant it. I went to the window, opened it, and emptied the kidney dish outside, apologizing silently to the groundskeepers as I did so. I rinsed out the bowl at the sink and replaced it in the medical cupboard, which I locked and returned the key to its mate. Stay quiet, I told her, as I changed back into my school uniform. Try to get some decent rest, but do me a favor. I wasn't here. You haven't seen me. You woke up, threw up, and suddenly you were feeling much better. Understand? Don't let them give you any more medicine. If they try to, scream bloody murder. And keep it up. I shall hear you. All right? Her eyes were upon mine, huge now. She nodded, and suddenly the tears welled up. I turned away. There wasn't a moment to lose. I was almost at the door when she called out to me.
Flavia?
I turned.
The dead person in the chimney? She said. The flag? Wrapped in the flag? I know her.
Chapter 17. There is an electric silence that comes with shock. A silence which is intolerable, yet which, in spite of that, you are powerless to break. I stood staring at Collingwood, and she at me, for what seemed like an eternity of eternities. I walked slowly back across the infirmary, placing one foot in front of the other, plod, plod, plodding toward her like some relentless zombie. Tell me, I said, perhaps too harshly, because Collingwood burst immediately into tears.
I can't, she sobbed. I simply can't.
And in an instant, I was catapulted back to that moment she and the corpse had come tumbling out of the chimney. How shockingly I had treated her. Put a cork in it, I had told her, and pointed out that she was drooling, and all the while the body had been lying there before us, decapitated on the floor. And who had harvested all the sympathy? Poor, dear, lonely, unhappy Flavia Deluce, as Miss Fawthorne had said. Well, poor, dear, lonely, unhappy Collingwood had been drugged and tossed into captivity. Not only did it not make sense, it was rapidly becoming a nightmare. By the time I reached Collingwood's side, I was feeling more dreadful than I ever should have thought possible. Tell me anyway, I said, gripping her hands in both of mine. And now the two of us were quaking with tears.
I can't, she whispered, squeezing tightly, and I saw in her eyes that she was telling the truth. In telling me that the dead body was someone she knew, she had already reached her limit. It had cost her dearly, and there was, at least for the time being, nothing else to share. What terrible kind of fear could so effectively silence the girl? Was the dead body an example of what happened to those who talked? What if I ask you questions? I said, suddenly inspired. That way you won't be telling, technically. She shook her head, and I knew that I was going to have to figure it out myself. The sound of cheering girls in the distance indicated that the day